Tonight on Arena. Paul McCartney on the Run, absurdism from the 1890s on the Sligo stage, and how Don Bluth brought Hollywood to Ireland. It is Wednesday night, just in case you haven't figured that out already. You're very welcome to Arena 51551 on text. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32 and you can email arena at rte.ie. To start tonight, the Beatles achieved every creative and professional peak imaginable in their relatively short time together. And by the time it was all over in 1970, each of the Fab Four was spent, exhausted by everything from the bloated business issues of Apple Corps to the sheer mental overload of what they'd all just survived. Paul McCartney went back to basics, living on the Mull of Kintyre with his wife Linda, bringing up their children and forming a new band called Wings. They went back on the road, calling into student unions to perform and building up again from a new set of foundations. Now there's a new documentary about him on Amazon Prime. It tells the story of what you do when you leave the biggest band in the world and try to salvage your sanity. Pat Carty is with me to talk about it, but before that, let's have a listen to a little of Man on the Run.
1, 2, 3,
the Beatles have been my whole life, really. When we split up, I thought, I'll never write another note of music ever. I had fear of being a grown-up. I felt very depressed, but I was very lucky because I had Linda.
Whoa, beautiful.
I said, if I form a new band, do you want to be in it? And she kind of, yeah. Okay, well, we've got two members. We started Wings from square one.
This is Paul McCartney of Wings.
It was about trying to do something different.
What am I doing singing with Paul McCartney?
When did you first discover Linda could sing?
On the wedding night.
Wings was a dud when it first came out.
If anybody bad-mouthed us,
I was thinking, I'm going to make the best record you've ever heard.
Pat Carty, you're very welcome to talk to us about this. You've been watching the documentary. Paul himself does the voiceover, but who's the director, Morgan Neville?
Morgan Neville has some form for this kind of thing. His brilliant 2014 documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom, was about backing singers in rock and roll. The people who kind of prop up your Jaggers and your McCartneys and things like that. And he won an Oscar for it, Best Documentary Feature. But that's not all he did. He did some great documentaries about Stax Records, Muddy Waters. There's a great one on Netflix about Keith Richards called Under the Influence, which he did as well. So he's the man for the job, you know.
Okay. It starts with a run through the entire history of the Beatles as if we need it, and it's fairly breakneck.
Yeah, and that's a risky manoeuvre, I think, because obviously everyone knows who Paul McCartney is, but when you see that at the start and you marvel again at the Beatles, and as you said, and the thing to remember here is I think McCartney was 27 when the Beatles broke up, but playing the Beatles at the start, you can't help but compare what comes after it, you know? Now, nothing by anybody compares to the Beatles, probably. And even though the Rolling Stones might be my favourite, I know technically I'm wrong that the Beatles were better. And, you know, so it's kind of brave in that way. But McCartney, as he mentions there in the trailer, is at a loss. I said, this goes along with a book called Wings, the Story of a Band on the Run that came out in November. And I said in my review of that, we're all of us know how to fail. But how do you follow up? Because nobody knows. Well, you're a fabulous personality. You can probably advise me on this, fabulous showbiz man. But how do you follow success? You know, if you're in the Beatles,
I've never been successful. I've no idea.
Like, imagine being Paul McCartney for a second, as I have many times in my life. But imagine being Paul McCartney at 27, and the Beatles is finished. You've done everything, and there's no one liked the Beatles before, and no one liked them since. So yeah, he would be depressed.
Because that is the shocking moment for me watching the beginning of this documentary, and it's the same thing that happened when I watched Get Back, because it's mentioned in Get Back as well. Is he's 27 years old at the tail end of the greatest band in rock and roll history, when he then has to go away and reinvent himself. And he talks about it in the documentary, where he says, the only thing I knew was I went to school and then I was in the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, when I was 27, I did not know my backside from the Channel Tunnel, you know. So, I mean, you know, for someone like McCartney to do that. And yeah, he knew nothing else. So he comes along, and as is mentioned there as well, as you mentioned in the intro, he hides away in Scotland. He's got this farm that he bought, and you can see in the documentary, the footage of it, it's a wreck. Mm. You know, it's a hovel, pretty much. And he takes to the bottle for a while, enthusiastically, and then he kind of pulls back from that. And he's married Linda at that stage, and they have two small children. One Linda's daughter, I think Heather, that he adopted, and their own, I might be getting the names wrong there, and Mary, or the other way around.
No, that's right.
Anyway, he's there, and eventually, you know, even though he said there in the trailer that he might never write a song again, Paul McCartney has music dripping out of him. Now, you mentioned the Get Back documentary. The scene that I always remember from that is when he wrote Get Back in front of us. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah, yeah. He was assing around on the bass, and Harrison and Starr were there, and they were a bit worse for wear, and he's just faffing around. And next thing, he pulls Get Back out of the air. So that man is a genius, if ever there was one in popular music. So he's never going to stop writing songs, I don't think, and still hasn't. So he gets a 4-track recorder into this farm and starts knocking about, making a very homemade thing. Now, we talked about this before the light went on.
We did.
And you don't really care for McCartney, the first album. I like it. But yeah, there's no denying it is ramshackle. But then it has a song like Maybe I'm Amazed on it, which is, I think, up there with his greatest songs. Now, the record isn't as good as the Beatles because the production is different, but the song is great. He's still got it.
Let's remind ourselves, as if we need reminding, of what Maybe I'm Amazed sounds like. I will agree with you. There are a few things finer than that.
That's pretty good, yeah.
I'm interested in this documentary. Is there a sense of McCartney trying to take back a little bit of the narrative? Because he gets to tell his side of the story so much after a time after the death of John Lennon. Mm. And it's talked about very early on in the doc that he took flak for a very long time for being the guy who broke the band up. And he kind of wants to redress that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that McCartney has done a lot in the last decade or two, really. You could say it started with the anthology stuff in the 90s, I think that was. But certainly in the book that goes along with this, and also in this, he's at great pains in this documentary to say at the start, as you mentioned, oh, he wasn't the one who broke up the Beatles, it was John, which technically is true. He was the one who announced it with that second album, Ram. He put a mock interview in with the sleeve notes or in with the press stuff and said, yeah, the Beatles are finished. You think about it, say, he had a book out called The Lyrics a couple of years ago. He had a book he wrote with Miles, his mate from the 60s, called Many Years From Now, where he kind of, and it's accurate, painted himself as the avant-garde one in the Beatles. So when Lennon was sitting out in his country pile, married, McCartney was the one going to see Stockhausen and people like that. And that's true. And
Lydia Derbyshire as well.
I think people at home would probably realise it now. I think McCartney was the best Beatle. In fact, I know. So let the phone lines ring up. He was, and that's all there is to it. He's remember there was a controversy as well. He wanted to have the Lennon-McCartney songwriting credit reversed for something like Yesterday, and which seems a bit petty now, and he gave up on it. I think Yoko Ono put her foot down and said, that's not happening. But yeah, it's like he's trying to get his house in order. And I think with this documentary, what he's trying to do is maybe, because Wings have come in for a lot of flack over the years. There's that famous joke from your man, what's his name, the comedian, oh, they were only the band, the Beatles it could have been. Knowing Me, Knowing You, Alan Partridge, that's it, yeah, that's who I couldn't think of. And and Wings, there is some bad stuff from Wings, but there's some great stuff as well.
Talk to me about the formation of the band, because the first album is pretty much solo, and it's essentially recorded on a 4-track in the middle of that pile on the Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah.
So about the formation of the band itself, how does the documentary walk us through him going, you know what, I might need another band?
Yeah, well, the first person he brings in is Linda, the missus, brings her in. So the second album, Ram, is actually credited to Paul and Linda McCartney. And then after that, and he had said to her, listen, if I get a band together, would you be in it? And she said, yeah, all right, I suppose, you know. And so then he gets Denny Lane, who was in the Moody Blues, an old mate, and he gets him in, so he's the third kind of cog in the wheel. And as you mentioned in your intro, I think they went around first of all and played in universities. And it's not as detailed as in the book, but it's very funny because they turn up at Students' Union and send in a roadie and go, listen, we've got Paul McCartney outside in the van. Can he play a gig tomorrow at lunchtime? And in the book, there's a lot of them interviewed going out and say, yeah, I had to go out and look in the van. You know, sure, I thought he was talking through his hat. And then Paul McCartney was there, and I still can't believe it. You know, and he was playing for 50 pence. He said he wanted to get back to square zero. Now, obviously, Paul McCartney's new band, he could have debuted at Madison Square Garden or wherever he liked. So he chose this way. Maybe it was a lack of confidence. I don't know. Or maybe he just wanted to, you know, iron out the creases before.
That Talk kind of to me a little bit about Linda's part in all this, because she has, firstly, the pivotal role in keeping him sane for quite a lot of that time. Mm. But what do you think she brought to the band and brought to Wings?
Well, I don't know about what she brought to the band, to be quite honest with you. There is a clip of her singing on her own, a song called Long Haired Lady, which is on one of those first two albums. And to be honest with you, the voice is a bit of an acquired taste, you know. And she says herself, you know, what do you do when Mozart asks you to sing in a band? And what do you do when Mozart says he can play keyboards as well? And McCartney says, well, I showed her middle C on the keyboards, so then she knew how to play. Now, that's okay if you're Paul McCartney. For the rest of us, that's not really enough lessons to play the piano. And, you know, but she was there. I mean, the thing that comes across in this and in the book is how much they loved each other and how much she wanted it. And it's a kind of a, he's kind of pioneering in a way by having the family in the band, so to speak, because the early tours, they toured Europe in an open-top bus and brought the kids with them and had mattresses across the top and had a great time. And, you know, it's as he mentioned in the trailer, I had to learn how to grow up. Well, that's as grown up as it gets, you know, that he brought his family with him, and it wasn't the same as being the young lad in the 60s and, you know, wherever I lay my hat, that's my home. It was more a thing like that in growing up. Now, she comes across in this documentary and in the book as an incredible woman, really. She was having the kids. She was doing this. She'd met him when she was a photographer, and her photographs are in this, and they're great. And one of the daughters says, look, McCartney had never met anyone like her before, a complete person. And they never spent a night apart at all after they got married, until McCartney dropped the ball in Japan, which I'm sure we'll come to.
Oh, we will. Give us a moment first. Wait till we play some more Wings. This is Band on the Run. Band on the Run, that's Wings here on Arena. Pat, hang on, talk to me about that album and about Picasso again.
Yeah, that's very well queued
up. This is something I did not know.
Right, that's a big hit album, Band on the Run. Everyone knows that. It sounds great in traffic, by the way, because I was stuck in it earlier on and I was listening to that. But there's a song on it called, just to show what a genius McCartney was and is. He's on holidays in Jamaica in early 73 or something like that, and he meets the actor Dustin Hoffman, who is in Jamaica to film Papillon with Steve McQueen. And Hoffman invites him to dinner. And he starts talking about songwriting. And there's a copy of Time magazine there, because Picasso has just died. And they had an article about his last words. And he says to McCartney, "Right, if you can write a song here, write a song about that," and hands him the magazine. So McCartney reads this and picks up an acoustic guitar. This is a story anyway. And starts playing this, and "Drink to me, drink to my health." That's the way the chorus goes. And Hoffman shouts for his wife, come in. He's doing it. He's doing it in front of me. And so, you know, there's another story about Live and Let Die that he sends out. He gets asked to do Live and Let Die, the theme tune, the Bond theme tune, sends out a minion on the Friday. Here, go out and get me a copy of this book, brings it back to the office or whatever. He reads it on Saturday, and then he writes the song on Sunday, and he records it on the Monday, you know. Mortal he isn't.
Talk to me about his relationship with John Lennon at this stage, because Paul had written on the Ram album a track called Too Many People, and then John writes How Do You Sleep. I hate to suggest that they're the diss tracks of their day, but they're not very far from it.
Oh, they are, yeah. How Do You Sleep, I mean, it says, you know, he accuses him of Muzak with an AK at the end of it. He says, yesterday was the only thing you did. Sergeant Pepper caught you by surprise. Now, that's hogwash, because Sergeant Pepper was McCartney's idea. But the story goes that he wrote a song. It's not in the documentary, but it's in the book, that when McCartney put out How Do You Sleep, or Lennon put out How Do You Sleep, McCartney had actually was going to record a song called Quite Well, Thank You Very Much. And I really wish he did. That would have been a great answer to it. But they made up in this in the early 70s. There's another, the first Wings single was called Give Ireland Back to the Irish, and which is not the greatest song he ever wrote. Maybe the sentiment is admirable, but that came out of, they were both in Lennon's apartment together and heard about Bloody Sunday, and then Lennon did a song called The Look of the Irish, which is even worse. Anyway, that's not worth talking about. But they were friends. They had got back together, and Sean Lennon is in this documentary, or his voice is anyway, saying, you know, that they had made up. And there's a great story. You know, everybody was asking him every time, and there's a good clip where it keeps going. The interviewers asking him questions. Oh, you're going to ask me that question. When are the Beatles getting back together? So in, I think, 75, 76, I'm not sure exactly the year, he's around at Lennon's place in the Dakota building in New York, and they're watching Saturday Night Live, which is not long on the television. And the what is your man's name? The producer or the creator of Saturday Night Live?
Lorne Michaels.
There you go, yeah. And he comes out and he does a skit where he holds up a cheque for $3,000 and he says, look, it's here. If Paul and John want to come round, and they can have this tax-free, here you go. And the two lads are watching this on the telly and thinking, will we do it for love? Will we hop in a taxi, you know? And they nearly did it. And McCartney says the reason they didn't, he says, oh, that's great news for them. What do we get out of it, really? So it never did. But they were friends. And he says at the end of this documentary, you know, when it gets to when Lennon was shot, that one of the great things in his life is that they'd made up. They were friends.
Tell me, Pat, who's going to enjoy this documentary?
Everybody.
Is it for Beatles completionists? Is it for the casual fan? It's for absolutely everybody.
Well, anybody who appreciates that, you know, melody and genius. I mean, I think it is McCartney-centric, obviously. And McCartney, as you said, is the big voice in it. And the same thing is with the book. So there isn't criticism of, say, Wings recording Mary Had a Little Lamb as their second single, which is disastrous, you know. And some of the albums are not great. But it's an interesting story because we know so much about McCartney in the 60s. Maybe we don't know as much about him in the 70s. And it's Paul McCartney. Who doesn't want to watch Paul McCartney for 2 hours? What fool doesn't want to watch that?
Pat Carty, it is a pleasure as always. Man on the Run is in selected cinemas and it's on Amazon Prime from Friday. Blue Raincoat, one of Ireland's only full-time acting ensembles, will stage a new production of Alfred Jarry's Ubu Hua at the Factory Space in Sligo from the 4th to the 14th of March. Written by Jarry when he was just 23 years old and first staged in Paris in 1896, Ubu Hua challenged every theatrical convention of its time. Its mix of crude satire, political parody and defiance of cultural norms later became the landmark influence on modernism and was the key precursor to the theatre of the absurd. I am joined now from our Sligo studio by actors John Carty and Sandra O'Malley. You're both very welcome to Arena.
Hi, thank you, Rick. Thanks for having us on the show.
John, I'm going to start with you. You play King Ubu. He is a grotesque character who has designs on the throne of the King of Poland. So tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he is a captain in King Wenceslas's army, and he has an ambitious wife, a la Lady Macbeth and Macbeth, and there's a couple of Shakespearean references throughout the play in a way. And so she encourages him to get up off his ass and, you know, maybe take the throne. And he does. And when he does so, he kind of goes a bit mental and becomes a bit of a despot and kind of goes out of control, basically.
I mean, that must be wonderful to be able to play as a character.
Absolutely fabulous. Having a great crack with it. It's a beautiful piece of writing. Very simply put, I mean, even the translation we're using is directly from the French, and it's quite direct in terms of the way it's presented or written, and kind of offers great opportunities for comedic kind of opportunities, and also for just kind of range, I suppose, as well too. Yeah.
Just, John, in terms of the play itself, it's an interesting one to choose to put on now. There are relatively few plays written by this man in 1896 that are playing anywhere in the world, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's a sort of a zeitgeist about it in a way. It has been on our radar for a while, I suppose, because we have delved into absurdism through plays through, say, Ionesco and a little bit of, I suppose, Flann O'Brien, if you want to include him in that kind of genre as well, too. So we've done a number of Ionesco. So I suppose it's been on our radar there for a while, and it just happens to kind of coincide with, I suppose, events that are happening worldwide.
Sandra, you're playing his wife, Mère Ubu, a bit of a Lady Macbeth about her. So tell me, why do you want to kill King Wenceslas, and how are you going about it?
Well, I suppose she has similar traits to him in a way. She's got her own sense of greed, ambition. She's bossy. She's vulgar. She has her own agenda and sort of wants a better position, I suppose, for herself, you know. So she essentially sets or plants the seed in his mind. She's the driving force behind his tyrannical reign, I suppose, and things get out of hand as a consequence.
Things get out of hand is putting it mildly, I think. There's quite a serious moment, and then the Queen flees with their son afterwards. There's a lot that goes on fairly early on in the play.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's 33 scenes in the play. There's five acts. Some of them are very short, but it really kind of covers a serious amount of ground. You know, and in terms of the numerous characters as well, John and I obviously just play Mama and Papa, but we've got four other actors that play multiple roles and try to sort of create whole armies on stage, considering there's only, you know, four of them. So it's, it's clearly
quite
been...
a feat.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
I mean, maybe for both of you, what is that like as performers when you're dealing with a cast like that, attempting to recreate so many roles? Is it slightly chaotic? Is it liberating? How does that work?
Chaotic, no. It's, I suppose, focused in a way, because you have to be theatrically clever, I suppose, in trying to create that vastness that is actually suggested in the play. Now, I don't know what the cast was in the original, but it certainly wasn't the numbers that are suggested in the play.
Yeah.
You'd be bankrupt if you did. So he must have utilised it and realised in a way that he wasn't looking for realism in many ways. And so the idea of actually just using six people or four people to do numerous characters lends itself to the play and its themes and its desires as a form.
Yeah, and he you know, would have had in mind as well, like, whether the scenes be short or long, and a lot of them are, you know, that very specific points, or, you know, he wanted to kind of get across in order to move it on, you know, because it's kind of fairly epic in its, you know, scale.
Yeah, Sandra, it's an ensemble piece and there are many characters, but how much does Jerry give the actors in terms of motivations, if anything?
Well, this is a funny one in that respect, in the fact that if when you start to analyse the play, like a lot of the absurdist work, if you take the psychology out of the actual presentation of it,
yeah,
then you actually get to the core of it, because it is exactly as it is on the tin, in a way. And actually, even the translation that we have is directly from the French. And so we didn't try to kind of set people down in different roads of imagination. If you do what he actually asks, you actually reap the rewards.
John, I know we've mentioned Theatre of the Absurd more than once here, but for people who maybe aren't familiar with it, tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, good question. No. well, I suppose my only reference of it is to the numbers of plays that I've done with Blue Raincoat, the Ionesco plays, which is Rhinoceros, The Chairs and The Bald Soprano. So, to me, I suppose absurdism is when you actually have a real situation, but the actual the circumstances are absurd, and that nearly shows the reality more so clearly, because it doesn't involve psychology. Does that make sense to you?
I would kind of add to that, in terms of the likes of Ubu, he has his own logic. You know, so he's kind of completely unaware of the chaos that he's causing. It's like a lack of coherence, an irrational kind of behaviour. So that's where I see the absurdity come from. And as Johnny kind of says, you know, when that's done in a sort of a realistic realism style, then you're kind of looking at something and you think it's normal, but it's actually quite berserk in the way it...
I'm interested in, and we've kind of briefly touched on it, but John, the play caused a stir when it opened.
It did. And it
wouldn't necessarily today in and of itself, but he's written a play in the late 19th century that's entirely relevant for an audience of 2026.
It's kind of incredible, really, in a way. You know, I'm sure his points of reference, you know, obviously meant something to him. He wasn't just taking it out of the air. So there was cultural references or global references that were happening that actually meant something to him. But I think, in a way, that now, mainly because of what we see across the water, in a way, is that it's so blatantly obvious in some ways, the actions that are being taken, that we can see it, you know, the wood from the trees. So that kind of gives it a very kind of current feeling, you know. if that makes sense.
And in terms of Sandra, what do you think audiences are going to take away from the play in the Factory Space on the 4th of March? Do you have any sense of that at all?
Good question. We hope they'll certainly be amused, entertained for the hour and 20 minutes. You know, it's quite vulgar, but it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a comic piece, you know. So it's got all sorts of flavours of illogical to irrational to ludicrous to, you know, the logic of kind of slaughtering everybody, you know. The world is just quite mad, and you know they kind of sail off to France at the end of it. I shouldn't maybe say that, but
Yeah, that's kind of important in a way, that they don't actually get their comeuppance in a way, you know, which is kind of pertinent as well too, you know.
Yeah,
it is for a young man, John, writing in the 1890s. It really is a remarkable play, isn't it?
It is. There was a whole thing about the fact that it started from even a younger age, that he used his old professor or something like that to as a reference point for this character. But what's also interesting is that in that first and that opening, it opened and closed on the one night, because I think the scatological references, the Paris audience found too much for them. But at the same time, there was people from the literati and of Paris and Europe in attendance on that first, like Yeats was in that, was in the audience, and the author whose name escapes me of Cyrano de Bergerac was in the
Rostand.
Audience, and yeah, exactly, and you know, so it wasn't as if it was something that was in a kind of a dark hole somewhere, and then people didn't know about it. It was quite prominent, and the people were very interested in what he had to say, even though I don't think he had any track record. So they obviously do. And also something like, I think I just read that Toulouse-Lautrec was on the design team. So there was obviously, you know, that kind of groupings that were going on in Paris at the time. There wasn't people cross-referencing to each other and cross-pollinating. There was a lot of that going on. And so I think that he had already spurred an interest, even though he didn't have any kind of work or form beforehand.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how it turns out on the stage in Sligo. John Carty, Sandra O'Malley, thank you very much for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Blue Raincoat's production of Ubu Hua will run at the Factory Space in Sligo from the 4th to the 14th of March. If you'd like more information, you can go to blueraincoat.com. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. If you grew up in the 80s or 90s, there's a very good chance your childhood imagination was shaped, at least in part, by the animated features of Don Bluth. For a time, Don lived and worked here in Ireland, releasing classic films like An American Tale and The Land Before Time. He revolutionised an entire art form and, in the process, helped build the very foundation of the Irish animation industry that we know and celebrate today. Bluth started his career at Disney, working as an assistant animator on the 1959 classic Sleeping Beauty when he was still a teenager. But driven by his uncompromising vision and guided by his devout Mormon faith, which deeply influenced his moral storytelling, Bluth made headlines in 1979 when he led a walkout of fellow animators to rival Disney itself. Here in Ireland, the real magic started in the mid-1980s when Bluth moved his entire operation to Dublin, establishing Sullivan Bluth Studios. It was an unprecedented move that essentially jump-started the modern Irish animation sector, paving the way for the thriving Oscar-nominated studios that we boast today. From their state-of-the-art facility in Island Bridge in Dublin, Bluth and his local team produced some of the era's biggest Spielberg-backed hits, including An American Tale and The Land Before Time. Although Don Bluth Studios ultimately closed its doors in 1995 after a difficult final run, its legacy is undeniable. In less than a decade, they'd achieved so much and changed the global animation landscape forever. Joining me now are David LaMattina and Chad N. Walker. They're the directors of a new feature documentary, Don Bluth, Somewhere Out There, which screens this weekend at the Dublin International Film Festival. And gentlemen, you're both very welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
David, Chad, the two of you met in 2005. You were working as entry-level assistants at Blue Sky Studios on major CG films like Ice Age. So how did that shape your perspective then when you were looking back at somebody who was a pioneer of hand-drawn art like Don Bluth?
Oh, I think it shaped everything, to be honest with you. You know, Chad and I worked together at Blue Sky with some fantastic artists, all people who came up just as we did, you know, on the hand-drawn animated films of people like Don Bluth. And so it was a world that we lived in for 7 or 8 years and got to know sort of inside and out. And it's a world we love, right? It's a world where we got to be creative and be around all those people. And it's such a small industry, right? That all the same stories, all the same people, they kind of all know each other. They kind of all, you know, work together. And so although Chad and I are not people that were ever going to pick up a pencil and draw, it's very much a world we're a part of. So it really shaped everything.
You described the documentary as sort of a spiritual successor to your previous film, I Am Big Bird, which looked at Carol Spinney, the man behind Big Bird. What is it about these men behind the curtain artists who kind of anonymously shape those millions of childhoods? What is it that draws you to their stories, Chad?
Well, I think that for me, I come from a heavy editing background. So for me, it's a successor to Big Bird in that we were able to dig into massive amounts of archival footage to get beyond the routine regular stories. When we started making I Am Big Bird, it actually... when we went into it, we were just thinking this is going to be a story of the man who played Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. But by going through the archival footage, we quickly realized this was a love story between Carol and his wife. And that is what led to Big Bird radiating love. And the same thing happened here when we started to dig into the archival footage with Don. We quickly realized that this was a story that had themes of art versus commerce. And also, it is a love story. It's just a love story between Don and his work.
David, I'm interested. Don is somebody who's famously protective of his work. So how do you go about winning the trust of Don Bluth to let you into all of that archive material that you then ended up using?
You know, I think for us, all of our projects, and certainly the ones that are successful, start from a place of love and respect. And so, you know, when it came to Don, we felt like he's someone that had an impact on us, not just as kids growing up, but, you know, as we sort of grew up and became artists of our own right. And so I think, you know, it's partially that love that he feels from us and that respect that he feels from us. But also, I think Chad and I are persistent to a fault. And so I think we first reached out to Don via a LinkedIn page, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And so it's just talking and taking the time and, you know, essentially building that relationship. I do think that that is something where tends to set Chad and I apart. It's just we really are interested in people and their stories, whether it is Don or somebody else. And I think that comes across. And so it really was just building that trust. But then also he had given his entire archive to the Savannah College of Art and Design here in Georgia. And so it was there, it was cataloged. And once he sort of gave us the green light, they opened the doors to us and we were able to go back through and really relive every part of his career in great detail.
Okay, I want to take a little something from the film. Here, Don talks about the importance of Walt Disney as an aspirational figure and the importance of Disney Studios as his competition.
For me, the hero of my young life was Walt Disney himself. I saw a picture in a magazine, I immediately tore it out, and here was this guy, and he was Walt Disney, and I said, he looks like the jocks. Very manly looking man, he had a mustache. That's the first time I've ever seen him, you know, and I said, that's what I can be also. I can also be a man and be an artist. I don't have to be a, you know, wuss.
You see Don Bluth Productions, quote, end quote, becoming the standard bearer as Walt Disney Productions were for animation? Are you trying to compete with Walt Disney?
I think what it will do, and I said this to them as we left too, we said,
we'll go out there and we'll fight it out on the screen. You know, we'll make it American competition the way it should be. It'll make you work harder and it'll make us work harder because they're number one. You know, so we're gonna have to work hard to try and let other people see that we mean business and that we're very serious about animation. Yeah, I wish I were a better businessman, you know, that's what I do wish. If we could make films that were even a little bit as good as Walt's early films, I would be very pleased.
And that's both Don Bluths from the film there, the interview footage from far more recently. And there you were listening to him talking as he was setting up the studios. David, maybe you could put Don Bluth in context for us in terms of how important a figure he is in the history of animation as an art form.
You know, I think what Don did, I know you talked about in the opening of the segment here, but, you know, clearly his impact in Ireland can't be understated. And it's one of the reasons it's so important for us to have the European premiere at the Dublin Film Festival is to go and honor that legacy and share with some of the people that we know are already attending that worked on those films. But I think beyond that, I think, you know, Don gave this interview on the release of All Dogs Go to Heaven, where he said, really, for animation to thrive, like, there needs to be competition, right? It can't just be one studio. We all have to basically be holding each other accountable. And I think what we see today is, you know, not just the major players, you know, the Disneys, the Pixars, but then you have Cartoon Saloon, you have all these other places that are making really gorgeous, beautiful work. And I think prior to Don and Gary and John showing people that that could be done, I just don't think people would have done that. So for him and Gary and John to strike out on their own when they basically had their dream jobs, I really think opened the door to the landscape of animation that we see today.
Chad, I wanted to ask you about this, and you've kind of touched on it briefly, but I'm interested in the process. So like the Carol Spinney film, it's built on hundreds of hours of personal archival footage. So when you're faced with that kind of mountain of material, how do you start to create a through-line narrative from that?
It's a great question. You know, inevitably, you're going through all the footage, and at first it's overwhelming, and more things are trickling in, and you're starting to get little hints of themes and stuff. But there comes a time, and this happened when the last time we interviewed Don, where you just find this magic, this bit of archive that's just magical. And the last time we interviewed Don, as we were walking out of the corner of our eye, we noticed there was a box sitting, off to the side in his room. And we said, Don, what's in there? He's like, I don't know. And we went in and it was all these film reels. And we're like, can we take these? We'll get them developed. He was like, sure. We take them, we get them developed, and it's the raw film reels of an interview that he did in 1979. We use a ton of that footage at the beginning of the movie. And then all of a sudden, like, the whole movie just comes to life because now you're seeing him before action. You're seeing him after cut, in this little witty banter. And then not only do the themes that you've been kind of pulling out this whole time, now the style of the movie starts to come to life. And so it's almost like this snowball that kind of like gains momentum, you know, the more you acquire and the more you go through.
David, you've mentioned that what came out of the footage was a portrait of a man essentially battling his own ego. He's torn between art and commerce. So how did that internal tension manifest it in himself, especially after he took that huge leap to leave Disney?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can see the transformation. If you watch the film and you watch the raw footage, you see this transformation. And it's one, honestly, that I think we felt ourselves when we struck out on our own and started our own company on a much smaller scale, obviously, than what Don did. But you can see that sort of youthful exuberance and artistic joy around the secret of Nim, and he starts to become this, like, they're so happy. They're really living their dreams. And then slowly, with sort of each financial burden that gets heaped on top of him because, you know, they've left the studio, now they're responsible for everyone. Each of those burdens starts to chip away. And Don even says it, like, you know, we had to keep making movies to keep people employed. We just didn't have good scripts, but we couldn't wait for a good script because we had to keep people employed. And so it really, I think, manifests in that thing that he's now not just an artist working purely and freely. He's now someone that is trying to figure out how he can keep things afloat. And that is a really hard place for an artist to work from. And I think you can see it in some of these things. One thing that Chad did brilliantly as also the editor of the film, I think, is that he used so much of the time after Dom, you know, someone would say cut. So you see an interview, you see these raw outtakes from interviews where he's either doing a promotional video or something, and you can sort of see that facade fall away. And you get that window into his soul of how crushing it can be to also have to do the commercial side of things as an artist. Mm.
This is a really good clip. This is interviewer here is the late, great Michael Dwyer, the very first person I ever interviewed when I was 19 years old. Here he is. He's talking to Don Bluth in Ireland about the importance of Steven Spielberg backing An American Tale.
So, Don, you and some of your colleagues took the brave move and broke away from Disney and went independent, and you made your own feature film, The Secret of Nim. Were you very disillusioned by the commercial failure of that film?
Oh, you know, I was disillusioned at first, but I made a rubber, and I bounced back very quickly. I know right after that happened, I always knew that something would pick us up, and we got a chance to do some video games. You know, we did Dragon's Lair, and we did Space Ace, and started into another Dragon's Lair, and again, the bottom fell out of everything for us because the arcade market disappeared. We thought, well, we're going down again. But it was at that moment that Steven Spielberg saw The Secret of Nim. And he said, where in the world did this come from? He said, I didn't think this could be done today. And he said, would you guys like to make a film with me? And we said, yeah, we'd love to.
An American Tale was a film that was finished in Ireland. So maybe, David, talk to me a little bit about when you spoke with Don, how he reflected on those Dublin years and what it was like, the energy of the studio there.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the energy at the studio was incredible. I think you had a bunch of people who were young, right? Because part of the deal with coming to Dublin was that Don and Gary and John would train young animators at Ballyfermot College. And so they were, you know, they had that great energy of the promise and everything. And I actually think Don looks at that period very fondly. I think there was obviously some disappointment that they couldn't keep it afloat. But I think it was a period where it was incredibly creative for him. He talks about something in the film called the Blue Note, which is that feeling that when art is just speaking through you and you're not in control of it and you just have to work, you just have to do the thing. And he called that Blue Note period, not during The Secret of Nim, not during American Tale, but during The Land Before Time, which was made entirely in Dublin. So I think it is a very fond period. And I do think that the screening, of course, Chad and I weren't there, but it's going to feel very much, I think, like a homecoming to have the film, play not that far from where the studio was.
There is an element of, and I'm interested for both of you, as filmmakers looking from the outside in, how clearly do you think you can draw a line from Don's arrival and his work in Ireland to the hugely booming Irish animation scene that we have today?
You know, it's funny, that was from our early days. Chad touched on it a little bit. When you start to develop a film, you think it's going to be one thing, and you get in and you talk to the person and you see the archive and it becomes a separate thing. But, you know, early days, we had this whole sort of through line of saying, well, you know, without Don doing all this in Ireland, you know, is the Irish animation industry where it is today? And I, you know, having not spoken to the folks at the heart of the Irish animation industry, I don't want to project, but certainly you would think that it. I think you used the word jump-started it. And I think that is accurate. And I think, you know, I don't know if Don sits around and thinks to himself, hey, I did this great thing and now Irish animation is doing really incredible stuff. But I hope he does. I really hope he does.
You got some great Irish talent scoring the film as well. You've got Fergal Lawler, the drummer from the Cranberries, wrote the music from his studio in Limerick. How did that come about, and what do you think that adds to the texture of the story as a whole?
I think this is going to be a two-parter. I'll start with how it came from, and then Chad can jump in. So the Cranberries happens to be my all-time favorite band, and a band that I've always wanted to make a film about. And so early days of this, you know, this project was sort of simmering in the background for Chad and I. And, you know, I reached out to Ferg via his website because he had been doing some, you know, more atmospheric music and was doing some film scoring. And I just said, look, a longtime fan, you know, first concert I ever saw, dream would be to make a film about you guys. But regardless, I really love what you're doing musically. And, you know, would love to talk about maybe scoring a film for us, thinking I would never hear back in 1,000 years. And within like a day or two, you know, we were on a Zoom and I was, you know, entirely geeking out. So that's the sort of inception. Chad, you could talk maybe musically what he brought to the film, because you worked so closely with him on the edit.
I mean, musically, he did such a fantastic job. It's probably, it's one of not, maybe the most, my most favorite score that we've done for any of our movies. But I'll just say that the passion that Ferg had, we've never worked with a composer that would just jumped in both feet and was just sending us, you know, wild track after wild track. So that made the editing process that much easier, because when I would go in, I'd actually be working with his music. And so as we were shaping themes in the movie, as we were shaping, you know, like I talked about before, the tone and the vibe of the movie, we were able to do it in lockstep with Ferg. And it was just such a blessing.
Just as a final question, I know you had the chance to show Don the finished film recently. What did he make of it?
You know, it's funny. We wanted to show him the film. And I realized the second we pressed play that we had never actually been in the room with one of the people our films was about the first time they saw it. And so I spent 90 minutes just with a complete flop sweat, feeling like, I don't know what's going to happen here and what's he going to say, because he was very honest, right? And I think a lot of times people are honest and say things or see things they said in the past in old archival footage that maybe isn't the way they wanted to see themselves, particularly in Don. You know, he talks a lot about his ego and how that has been a challenge for him over the years. But to his credit, he, you know, like he gave us some notes, which was kind of awesome. But then on the way out the door, he just put his hand on, you know, our shoulder and said, you guys should be proud. And I was like, that's one of those moments that, you know, sometimes making these films can be challenging. It can be a sort of a lonely process when Chad and I are in a dark edit room. But to have that moment where this guy who made these things that, you know, I have shaped who I am as a person, say that was really a really special moment for us.
Well, it's been great to talk to you both tonight, David LaMattina and Chad N. Walker. Thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thank you so much.
The film Don Bluth Somewhere Out There screens as part of the Dublin International Film Festival this coming Saturday, February 28th at the Lighthouse Cinema. For information and tickets, you can visit diff.ie. And before we go, here's a little something to remind us of an American tale. I hate to break into your air guitaring in the centre of Linda Ronstadt and James Ingram's Somewhere Out There, but that is it for us tonight on Arena. Tomorrow night we are reviewing the week's new film, including The Testament of Anne Lee, Surratt, and Scream 7 is out as well. We'll have a look at a new anthology retelling the stories of mythological Irish women. And we're going to talk to legendary pianist Mike Garson about his work on record and on tour with David Bowie. That's all tomorrow night. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields is our researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And our sound supervisor tonight was Patter Carney. John Creedon is next. I'll talk to you tomorrow.